So I begin with a desire to talk about body and ways that it is limited by architecture. Today my focus will be on the relation between the second wave of feminism and architecture, and then the role of architecture in forming political, behavioral, moral, sexual, gender and family identities and codes. Anyone who have learned Yugoslavian art history would tell me that I cannot speak about this in the 80s, because the influence of second wave feminism actually came later to art in Yugoslavia. But that is not the case with architecture, for the reason that Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, after the World War II and the People's Liberation War, the Yugoslavian communists, among other things, exposed gender equality. In the course of the socialist revolution, significant results were achieved, and that meant that women were getting a lot of jobs that they weren't able before the war. They were more educated. They had policies regarding divorce, abortion, and maternity leave. But that is, on the other hand, women were furthermore not highly represented within leadership bodies and were still obligated to work full-time and be housewives at the same time. So the men of the house expected lunch on the table after work, a clean house, and always a lovely, pretty wife. That is something that I don't say without references. I will show you the research that was done in the 80s by the Center for Housing that later gave a proposal of typology for housing in Yugoslavia that actually had one problem with it regarding women. And now I can start. There were handbooks that explained what a woman should do, and a good woman knows her place in the house. That is the kitchen. two, three. Okay. So, I'm sorry that I'm reading this, because I was intending to say it, but I'm so excited that I can't. So, behind this desk, I don't really feel at ease to talk about this subject dedicated to enforced cultural limits of women through her body. Thinking about ways to talk about the body that would be appropriate, to talk about the body limits that would be appropriate, I understand that in situations like this, highly formal and conventional, we are all together actually examining limits of our body's invisibility. When I'm talking to you about the body, it is not my body that is getting the communication with your bodies, otherwise we would not be sitting here still, trying not to move in any way that would disturb this non-bodily situation. But my body would communicate with your bodies in some bodily way. So thinking about the way to talk about body limits and not betraying the body, I realized that we are examining body limits of social conventional non-existence. So I have to ask you to participate in this by trying not to move, not to cough or sneeze, or let any let your body express itself in any way. If you agree, everything is fine, and I can continue. I start from the idea that the body is a site where culture and regimes of power inscribe themselves. That is something that we take for granted even ever since Foucault's History of Sexuality. Judith Butler points out that in a number of texts, Foucault clearly asks if there is a materiality to bodies that could be separable from cultural meanings. And he gives an answer that even the most phatic aspects of the body, such as sex, are fully invested with the ideas. Starting from this idea, I chose to examine Kafka's short story In Penal Colony, there, where we have process of culture being inscribed into the body in a literal way. In the penal colony, on an unknown island, there is a machine that is punishing convicts by inscribing into their skin and flesh the rule they broke. The machine is intended to make them read the text after 6 hours of torture and then spend last 6 hours of their life in a peaceful bliss of revelation caused by this reading of one cultural text. There are other questions connected to this colony that I would like to think through later in this work. But now, contrary to starting belief that body is just a construct, I would ask myself, together with Judith Butler, if there is a body external to the construction, invariant in some of its structures, and which in fact represent the dynamic locus of resistance to culture per se. I'm sorry, that was a quote. And I find something interesting in a way Butler gives a response to this question. That is again the idea of limit. She says that if a body is locus of resistance to culture, it is in fact not culturally constructed, but it represents limit and failure of cultural construction. It is a big turnover, even since Foucault, limits were connected to cultural inscriptions and powers imposed to the body. Here Butler makes it vice versa. For me, this is important because it shows the question of limits is key question connected to our possibilities of thinking about the body. Whether it is the culture that is setting limits to the body, or body being a threat and limit to the culture, their inseparable relations, their interdetermination is one of the key points in recent history. The culture as history is inscribing itself on surface of bodies which are being blank and ready to take any inscription. There is a machine punishing convicts by inscripting the text of their bodies, literally writing it into the flesh. Just a minute. For Foucault, bodies are involved in political field. They are there to carry tasks, to perform ceremonies. Why did I talk about this at all? Is because I wanted to come to the point where I can say that no matter who would be the one punished, there is no punishment without the body. So there is no inscriptions of culture without the body. So the body, the gender and everything is a construct, but it is a construct that is based on the body and the existence, physical existence of it. So the case study. The Center for Housing during the 80s, which were later used for forming Yugoslav National Building Code. In this study on the space functionality, the Center for Housing suggested two models of family, in respect of which it conducted its research. So I need to change the... Sorry. I can show you all of them, but since it's in Serbian, it doesn't matter for you. I will explain the main thing about it. They suggested two types of family. One is a model that has a mother that works, and the other is a model that has a mother that doesn't work. So the woman is not even mentioned, or she is non-existent if she is not a mother. She cannot exist in the society, and there is no typology for housing that supports that kind of family. So not only a woman isn't supposed to live alone, a woman isn't supposed to live in a marriage or partnership with someone, a woman isn't supposed to exist if she doesn't procreate. This is actually the table that they did. They analyzed the movement in the apartment and which rooms the mom that is working and the mom that is not working uses the most. That is not so important at this moment, so I can come back. The point was to show the family. So proposed structure of the family clearly alienated a possibility of existence of family that is not only one member, a family that consists of heterosexual couple of equals, where a woman is not necessarily a mother, or homosexual couple with children, single parent families, and so on. Viewed from this from the perspective of biopolitics, architecture that is a result of this research is not just limiting, but it shapes everyday life of a family. It builds gender, sexual, and family identity of every individual that will use it, and it does it in a way that the user will never be conscious of the restraint. In the very output of this research and the way it was conducted, a very strict and precise user guide is encoded, a user guide that carries all aspects of national ideology in which it was made. That national ideology or state ideology in this way serves a set of rules, all the rules that are necessary to follow in order to produce a healthy family individual. When speaking of American neoliberalism, Foucault mentions a text by a Scottish economist and philosopher, Adam Smith, in which Smith explains the phenomenon of invisible hand. While Smith refers to the invisible hand as something that guides a common salesman towards fulfillment of a goal in which his intentions take no part, Foucault deems that we should not insist on the existence of a hand which connects all the strings and guides people without them knowing how or why, and in doing so, following its own interest brings gain to all, but that we should pay attention to the invisible aspect of the mentioned hand. Later, he infers to this as the basic characteristics of biopolitics and the way it manages to penetrate into habit and everyday life of an individual. Earlier, Foucault mentions Bentham's panoptical system, in other words, surveillance house, that is not simply a model used for penitentiary institutions, but an, quote, idea for a new construction principle, end quote, which could be applied to all kinds of institutions that practice surveillance, ranging from industrial halls, offices, schools, hospitals, sanitariums, and among which he mentions homes of the poor. The fact that Bentham mentions the homes of the poor is this list of institution in this in list of institution indicates that the poor should be controlled and regulated. A highly applicable and adaptable building principle is given for that purpose, which could be, with its structure, even without direct supervision from above function, a restrictive system. Owing to its structure, in other words, typology, the house limits and enables precisely those functions that are planned. Bentham does not present the implementation of the, just a second. sorry. Do you see number four? Of the surveillance, how simply as a mandatory procedure that would enable behavioral monitoring of an individual, thus enhancing profitability and productivity of their activity, but he states that it is mandatory formula for government, quote, because what in fact does a government have to do? It definitely has to give way to anything that could represent natural behavior mechanisms and production. It has to give way to these mechanisms, and it is necessary not to have any other form of intervention, at least in first instance, besides surveillance. He concludes that the government may intervene only when it sees limited to monitoring. In that sense, residential architecture certainly performs the surveillance role over the user, meaning that it imposes typology that imposes function of every space and therewith molds rules of conduct by its shape, size, function, and furniture layout of the room. That can be also connected to Umberto Eco's thesis about architecture as communication, where he's claiming that we learn how to use our furniture, and we use it only the way that is proposed. The stairs are stimulus that makes us climb, because we want to cross from one level to another. And in that sense, Eco's logic about stairs could be applied at any piece of furniture in everyday space and on any form of space itself. As I said, we are sitting here, we are in our chairs, no one is lying on the ground, I'm not lying on the ground, because we are taught to, we are supposed to sit on the chair. There is possibility of using the chair in a different way, but we usually do not, because it's inscribed in us. Sorry? Okay. In her book, How We Survived Communism and Even Left, Slavenka Drakulić vividly illustrates what, for all its idealistic claims, communism ignored the basic needs of women. In the 70 years, quote, in the 70 years of its existence, it couldn't fulfill the basic needs of half the population. Drakulić proclaims, as she describes the lack of sanitary napkins or tampons made available to women during the communist era. Women had to wash the bloody cloth pads every month again and again, as their mothers and grandmothers and grand-grandmothers did hundreds of years ago. This is actually true. My mother, grandmother, and even my sister, who is not much older than me, they simply didn't have they couldn't have the pads, so they had to use sleeves or anything, any piece of cloth that could be used. And it was usually hidden from the girls and never talked about, even in the 60s and 70s, which is unimaginable in any modern society. The reappearance of bidet in the space of Belgrade apartment can be characterized as in the direct influence of second wave feminism. Why am I mentioning that it's a direct influence, and mentioning still that is happening in the apartment that only can hold a woman that is a mother? So the impact of feminism second wave feminism wasn't strong, it was just going they filtered it in a way that suits the state, anyway. With efforts of weakening traditional authorities and fighting for abortion rights for women, decriminalization, the alternative forms of sexuality, and suspension of censoring of sexual content in literature, art, mass media, was to educate and bring closer so far hidden aspects of sexuality. So the concept of sexual education guides and books for grown-ups became widely accepted in order to support practicing the right and healthy sex life. When I say right and healthy sex life, I don't mean it by my standards, but by communist standards. The sexual education of children was done through the institution of family. And now, bidet, translated from French, a pony, is used for hygiene of intimate parts after using the toilet, for keeping hygiene during the menstrual bleeding, and after intercourse. Even though it was invented in late 17th and early 18th century in France, its mass use and production came to Yugoslavia with the Belgrade apartment. Bidet as an object, being that its use is clearly defined with its existence, used as a tool for raising awareness of existence of intercourse and intimacy of the parents, it raised awareness about the reproductive health and nature and anatomy of female and male human body, and in that way promoted some of the ideas of sexual revolution, which would never be mentioned within the communist Yugoslavia. But of course, since it was filtered, you can, it's, there is a paradox, because bidet appears in the same typology of housing that is the center of housing, that the center of housing suggested. Interesting enough, the same typology that suggested the non-existence of woman if she does not procreate. It suggests the zones of housing where one of them is sleeping, one of them is dining, and one is for company. In the bigger apartments, it will have one bathroom for the children and one for parents. The bathroom for the parents will be next to their sleeping room, and it will have a bidet. To be clear, before '60s, why is this important to say that it is influencing and raising awareness? Before '60s in Serbia, there were no toilets in the apartments. So not every apartment had a toilet, but all, for example, the whole building had one toilet, and it was outside of all the apartments. So when the toilet came in, it changed nothing. But 20 years later, when the bidet came in the toilet, it changed everything, because now it became normal to talk about period or sex life, because people before the appearance of bathroom in the house didn't shower every day. That came later. They showered maybe every week, and they used the bidet in the middle time for sexual hygiene, literally, or intimate hygiene, however you want to put it. Then, of course, the bidet through time disappeared because people started using the shower every day and lost its use, but it left a trace regarding to how women should behave, or at least what a healthy sexual life is. I don't have anything else to say.